Good evening, everyone, and welcome back again for the third of the three installments of the three principles aspects of the path. So, of course, this evening's topic is wisdom, the third of the three principal aspects. But maybe we can spend a few minutes to review a little bit what we've covered so far before we launch into the wisdom discussion. So again, remember this text was written by Lama Tsongkhapa, and it's really a synthesis of the Lam Rim texts that he wrote, the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment texts. And here he's really saying that the three core elements within that Lam Rim are these three topics of renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, or wisdom, emptiness. And so again, he, at the beginning of his text, he pays homage to the perfect gurus, the teacher, highlighting that the root of the path is relying on a teacher, a qualified teacher, and that if we really want to follow the spiritual path effectively, there are a lot of advantages to having our own personal teacher. And then, of course, the first part of the path is to first recognize the opportunity we have in this life and the fact that it's not going to last forever. So they were the first two reflections as part of the renunciation, developing renunciation, was to come to see what a wonderful opportunity we have as a human being with all these good conditions. But these good conditions are not going to last forever. In fact, we don't know how long we're going to live. So if we have these two reflections together, we will really develop an aspiration not only to make our life meaningful, but to do that now and not wait for some later point in our life. Then, of course, the foundation of a meaningful life is ethical lifestyle. So that was the third topic, really, in the topic of karma, to really appreciate that how we begin to make our life meaningful is to have an ethical lifestyle. But then, of course, we can understand that even if we have an ethical lifestyle and have relatively good conditions in this life, we're still subject to all sorts of physical and mental problems. And so, therefore, we can go on to reflect about this, and what we can come to appreciate is that the potential for problems and sufferings is coming from our contaminated mind. That it's our mental afflictions such as anger and jealousy and craving and resentment and fear, anxiety, depression. It's these mental afflictions which are underlying all of our sufferings. And then if we investigate that even, we come to appreciate that these mental afflictions are not an inherent part of our mind. In fact, there is a number of modern philosophies that say that these mental afflictions are sort of hardwired in our brain, that the nature of the human existence is anger or whatever. But what the Buddha discovered was that these things, such as anger, may be strong, we may have strong habits of them, but they are coming from a mistaken view of reality. That the reason they're there is that we have a mistaken view of how we exist in the world around us exists. When we come to appreciate this, we can then really come to appreciate that we can eliminate this underlying source of all of our suffering. Hence, we can then develop the first of the three aspects, renunciation, developing the aspiration to break free of this type of existence because we realize that it's possible. So this renunciation, again, remember, is the aspiration to strive for liberation from suffering. this aspiration to strive for this goal of nirvana, a state completely free of suffering. So that's how we develop this aspiration. And then when we fully develop this aspiration, we have really entered into the Buddhist path, the path to liberation. But then Lama Tsongkhapa goes on to let us be aware that, of course, that we are not the only ones in this state of dukkha, of suffering, but all mother sentient beings are in a similar position. And we can then go on to develop the aspiration of not only wishing to liberate ourselves from suffering, samsara, but develop the wish to liberate everyone else from suffering. But of course, to be able to do that, we need to have the capacity to do that, which we don't have now. Then we can come to realize that if we achieve full enlightenment, we can have that capacity. And so hence then we would go on to develop the second of the three principal aspects, developing that mind of bodhicitta, the mind which aspires to full enlightenment, so that we can help liberate everyone else from suffering. But then of course that is not enough, as we're going to see in the text here, that if we really want to escape from samsara and achieve that full goal of full enlightenment, we need to develop this wisdom of emptiness. And that's where we are now, to have a look at the reason we have to develop this wisdom. The reason, the outline says, the reason to meditate on the right view. The right view here means the right view of reality. So if we look on page 143, the last verse on that page, it says, without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you have generated renunciation and the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent arising. So here, again, it's saying that we need to develop this wisdom together with renunciation and the mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta. And this also really highlights a point that I already mentioned last night, is that if we want to follow any spiritual path, then we need to focus on two aspects. Just like a bird needs two wings to fly to a certain destination, if we want to progress along the spiritual path, we need two wings as well. And those two wings are called, normally called method and wisdom. Method being all the virtuous practices that we engage in together with wisdom. And of course, all of those practices are sustained and motivated by compassion. So therefore, often the two wings are called compassion and wisdom. So here, of course, the first two, renunciation, is all about compassion for ourselves. And, of course, bodhicitta is the highest level of compassion for everyone. And as I mentioned yesterday, often people who enter the spiritual path tend to gravitate to either compassion or wisdom practice and often ignore the other side. And usually, if that happens, we end up with some problems. And to reiterate those from yesterday, people who sort of gravitate towards the wisdom wing and forget about the compassion wing, often people like this become very self-absorbed, become very disconnected from the world, often become very insensitive to others, and in very extreme cases, they become very unethical, thinking because they're some high-level wisdom practitioner, they're beyond ethics, so it doesn't matter. You know, because everything's empty, so it doesn't matter what I do. So this can happen. And likewise, people who gravitate to the compassion wing and neglect wisdom often find themselves in trouble as well. Of course, if we have compassion without wisdom, then we can have a very biased compassion, meaning, yes, I'll help these people because they deserve help, but these people here, they're not nice people, so I'm not going to help them. So our compassion can be quite biased. But also, of course, without wisdom, even with the best intention in the world, often, and we know this from our own experience, often we try to help others, but we make a big mess of it, and because we're not really knowing what to do. And so we end up not only not helping people, sometimes we end up creating more problems because of lacking of wisdom. But of course, also, I think as mentioned, Claudio yesterday, that that compassion without wisdom, it can become a little bit of an ego trip, you know. Often people who do this can get a very sense that they're very sort of a good person, a very important person, a very special person. In fact, I'm better than everyone else because no one else is doing as much good as me. So it can become a little bit of an ego trip. Also, of course, as I mentioned yesterday, particularly people who have a huge enthusiasm to help others and go out and try and fix the world, often end up with compassion burnout, overextending themselves, thinking that they can fix every problem in the world, not knowing when to rest. So again, this is all to do with lacking wisdom. The wisdom understanding how we can help, how we can't help, and the wisdom of knowing when to rest. And another point is, and I think probably we've all experienced this at some time, is that we try to help others and then they take advantage of us. Again, this is compassion without wisdom. Here the wisdom is to not allow that to happen. So we can be very firm if people are really trying to take advantage of our good nature, without attacking the person, of course. So we don't do the cognitive fusion, but we can not allow that. And that is the wisdom that comes with compassion. So here, again, we need to have both of these wings. And particularly here, Lama Tsongkhapa says that without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, meaning the wisdom realizing how everything exists, without that, then we can't cut the root cause of circling. Circling here means circling in samsara, meaning we're stuck. The root cause of us in samsara is this fundamental ignorance which misunderstands how we exist and how the world around us exists. So he says here, therefore attempt the method to realize dependent arising. So how does that fit with this ignorance? So remember, ignorance misunderstands nature reality. So ignorance here is not simply not knowing how things exist. Ignorance here is actively misunderstanding. So ignorance here is a belief in an independent me and an independent objective world. So we need to develop the wisdom understanding there is no independent me, no independent world. Which of course means that that there is a dependent me and a dependent world. Hence, by realizing no independent existence, we are realizing that everything is a dependent phenomena. Hence, here it says, realize dependent arising. Dependent arising is the Buddhist term for that. Arising here means coming into existence. So dependent arising means everything comes into existence dependently. So this is what we need to do, is we need to come to develop this wisdom to overcome our ignorance. The wisdom realizing that there is nothing exists independently, that everything is a dependent arising. So if then we go over to the page 144 at the top, it says showing the right view. It says here, one who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence and a state beyond sorrow as forever unbetraying, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. So here we see that the first sentence or first part, the first phrase, talks about one who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence, samsara, and the state beyond sorrow is a direct translation of nirvana. So basically saying that seeing every phenomena within samsara and nirvana as forever unbetraying. Unbetraying means here that everything is dependent on causes and conditions. That's why it says here the cause and effect of all phenomena. So here we are saying that one who sees that every phenomena in whether it's samsara or nirvana as being a dependent arising, as being dependent on causes and conditions, so that's the first part, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared. So here, of course, the grasping mind is the mind that grasps at myself as a person, as existing independently, and grasps at an independent, the objective world, the world existing independently as well. So the grasping mind here is just simply another name for ignorance. The ignorance which grasps at things existing independently. If we talk about that ignorance with respect to ourself as a person, then that ignorance is called self-grasping. Grasping at a self. Remember, a self is a belief in an independent me. So we're grasping on a self, we're grasping onto me as a person existing independently. So it says here, and for whom any object trusted in the grasping mind has completely disappeared. In other words, that for someone, whenever we look at any phenomenon, then that independent phenomenon has completely disappeared, meaning that we have come to realize that nothing exists independently. So that's what the second statement is. The first statement is saying all phenomena, whether it's samsara or nirvana, seeing them as a dependent arising, depending on causes and conditions. The second one is saying, and for whom every phenomena is lacking independent existence. Someone who sees these two things has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas, meaning that we have understood the correct view, we have understood the view of reality, that everything is both a dependent arising and everything is lacking independent existence. So let's now look then at some detail as to how we are to understand that. How are we to understand that everything is lacking independent existence, and how are we really to understand that everything is a dependent arising? First off, terminology. So remember again now here, the root cause of samsara is this fundamental ignorance. The fundamental ignorance which believes in an independent me, independent objective world. Simply believes in independent existence. Now, generally in the Buddhist texts, when they talk about this belief in independent existence, independent me, independent objective world, there's a couple of terms that are used to describe this word. Probably the most common term that you'll hear is inherent existence. Inherent existence has this sort of idea that things are existing within themselves. They're self-existent. So this is what inherent existence. Things exist within themselves. They're self-existent. There's another term that's commonly used is things existing from their own side. And this has the idea that things are existing from their own side, meaning that we are in no way contributing to the existence of things. Things simply exist from their own side, meaning there's already a world out there existing, simply waiting for us to experience it. So that's what existing from its own side means, that things are existing without the need of the observer, the one who experiences them. They exist from their own side, simply there, already existing independently, simply waiting for us to experience them. A third term that's used often is true existence. That you'll also see that quite often. Generally, we say that something is true if it doesn't deceive us. So here, true existence means, you know, when we look at this cup, for example, it appears to exist independent of us. If it in fact existed in that way, it would be true. Meaning, the way in which it appears and the way in which it exists match. That's what true existence means. True existence means something existing in the way it appears. It's not appearing one way and existing another. Then it wouldn't be true. So true existence means existing in the way in which it appears. And so things, of course, appear to exist independent of us, and if in fact they existed that way, they would be true. They would have true existence. So these three terms are all talking about independent existence. And they're describing independent existence from a slightly different perspective. But they all amount to the same thing, independent existence. So whenever you see these various words in a text, that's what they mean. So of course, what we're saying here is that things really do appear to exist independently. There really does appear to be an independent me here, and an independent objective world out there. But what this view is saying is that things do not exist in this way. So what this view here is saying is that things are empty of inherent existence. Things lack inherent existence, or very simply, things are not independently existent. So the fact, this phrase here, empty of inherent existence, this is emptiness.
When you say things, do you mean...
all phenomena.
Things
or phenomena. So that's emptiness. The Sanskrit word for emptiness is shunyata. Shunyata. So again, emptiness is the fact that things are empty of inherent existence. They are not independently existent. Why? Because they're dependently existent. So this is the view we are looking at here. is that things are empty of inherent existence, they're not independent existent, which is emptiness. Why? Because they are dependently existent. Here a word arising means coming into existence. So again, what we need to be clear about here, this word emptiness, emptiness doesn't mean nothing really exists. That's nihilism. Emptiness is saying things are not independent. Why? Because they're dependent. So again, emptiness is not saying things don't really exist. If you see the word emptiness, you've got to say empty of what? What are things empty of? They're empty of being independent. They lack that. They're not independently existent. That's what emptiness means. Now, we saw just previously in showing the right view that one who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena as forever unbetraying, meaning that one who sees everything as existing depending on causes and conditions understands dependent arising. But we can understand things as dependent arisings in three ways. So to have a better understanding of what we mean by dependent arisings, and therefore to better understand what we mean by emptiness, let's have a look at that now. So things are dependent phenomena. Things come into existence dependently. The first one that's already mentioned here is that things exist depending on causes and conditions. For example, this clock here exists depending on causes and conditions. One of the very first conditions necessary, of course, someone had to think about designing this clock. Then, of course, all the various raw materials needed to be gathered. Those raw materials needed to be refined. All the various components of this clock needed to be manufactured. All those various components needed to be assembled. And then, of course, all the factories, people, and all other things that were involved in that whole process were also necessary. So all of those causes and conditions were necessary for us to have this clock here now. I think that's fairly straightforward. I mean, that's, I think most of us can sort of appreciate that without too much thinking. The second way in which things are dependent arisings is they depend on their parts to exist. So again, likewise, this clock can only exist depending on all the parts, the plastic casing, the battery, the electronic components in the front, the different hands on the face of the clock, without the numbers, all of these things. So without all of these parts here, there's no clock. So again, I think that's something fairly easy to understand, not really rocket science. But remember, the fact that things are dependent arisings should be convincing us or proving to us that things are empty of independent existence. I mean, that's what we're saying here. So the fact that we understand things to be dependent arisings should be overturning our belief that things are independent. But I'm probably safe in saying that most of you can very easily, happily accept that this clock exists depending on causes and conditions and its parts. You can quite happily accept that, and at the same time accept the fact that when you walk in the door, there's already a clock sitting here. True? No? But that shouldn't be true, according to this statement. The fact that we understand this is existing depending on cause and conditions and parts should mean that we come to realise that this clock is not sitting here on the desk waiting for us to experience it when we walk in the door. Doesn't seem to have that effect, does it? That understanding doesn't seem to negate our belief that this clock is existing independent of us, does it? Why? Because it should. Logic dictates that it should. The reason it doesn't, or not easily, I mean, if we're very intuitive, it would, but generally the reason is because we only understand these two ideas at a very sort of superficial level. To really understand them at a deeper level, we need to look at the third way in which things are dependent arisings. That things exist depending on imputation, labelling, conception. These are all three different words for the same thing. So when we hear that, we might think again, oh yeah, I know what that means. That means that this cup here, existing depending on imputation, labelling, conception, means that there's a thing here which I'm calling a cup. That's what that means. Again, that's quite superficial understanding. Because what's really going on when we look out on the world is when we look out on the world, what is coming in through our senses, particularly through our eyes, is just a mass of sense data. A mass of sense data. And of course, we may need to make some sense out of this data. Otherwise, we couldn't function in the world. Otherwise it would just be, we couldn't do anything. So what we need to do is to divide up all this data into meaningful chunks so that we can sort of make sense out of all the data. So what we do is we draw lines around various collections of data and conceptually isolate that into one object to make some meaning out of what we see. But on top of that, of course, is that we live in a world with others. To be able to communicate with others, we need to give names or labels to those things that we've made up in our mind. So hence, conception or labelling or imputation is that process of drawing a line and then giving a name. Even if we don't give a name, we've already labelled because we've turned a collection of data into an object that is already labelling or conception, because we've conceptually isolated a group of data and made it into a single object. So this is what we mean by this. How we divide up the world is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary depending on the context, depending on the meaning that we want to get out of what we see. For example, if we all look behind me here, we could simply see all that data and say that there's one big wall cabinet. So that we could say there's simply one object back there. Or we could divide it up into 2, 4, 3, 7. We could divide it up into 7, say there's 7 display cabinets there. Or we could divide it up into, ooh, I don't know, about 15 or something, and say there's 15 statues there. Or we could divide it up into probably about 30 or 40 and say there's about 40 offerings there. So how many things are there? Is there 1, 5, 7, 15, 30? How many? Depends. Depends completely on us. The world, so we divide up the world. We draw lines and give meaning, give names. So it's not fixed how the world is divided up. Therefore, this third point, you often hear in Buddhist texts say that things are merely labelled. merely labelled. Merely labelled means that it's not existing from its own side. There's not a thing there already. Merely labelled means that we are creating that object by drawing a line around a certain collection of data and giving a name. Which means if we search amongst the bases, the data, there's no object to be found there. Because the object is being created in our mind. So we can say that things are merely labelled and they're not findable amongst the bases. Clear so far? Maybe.
Is it too early to ask a question about that?
No, go.
Because I understand what you mean in terms of appearance, and it's labelled in terms of appearance, but there is a planet Earth and there is a sun and there are objects there, and if I disappear, those objects are still there for everybody else. But eventually, over billions of years, they will disappear as well. But in terms of...
All of these arguments, we have to look at those sorts of arguments, and that's coming a bit later, in terms of who are we, the person. A lot of those arguments, like a lot of people argue, well, but there is, if I'm not in the room, there's still a cup there. But the assumption when people have these sorts of arguments is inbuilt in their question is that there's a me, independent me. That's the assumption they have when they ask these questions. Which, of course, if there's an independent me, there must be an independent cup. Must be. So what we need to do is to go back and look at, is there an independent me? Because if we're asking, these questions about the world, on the assumption that there's a me here who's asking that, then there's no answer to the question because you're asking the question with an invalid assumption.
Yeah. Okay,
so that's one of the things, the hurdles we need to overcome. And that's why, as we're going to see, when we investigate nature reality, generally we start to investigate ourselves as a person because that's where the whole process starts to go wrong. Based on grasping, on self-grasping, based on grasping that there's an independent me, of course that naturally means there must be an independent world.
Okay. Independent, I don't have trouble understanding that we're creating this sense of independence.
So your question about the universe and stuff has that built into it, that assumption?
Because what I'm understanding is, and I think I'm misunderstanding, is that you're saying the world is dreamlike, and that
dreamlike, yes, that's one analogy that's used.
And so that there is a place of waking up where the dream disappears, in a sense, the forms of. But I
remember, if we wake up in a dream, does the dream disappear?
No.
Our perspective of the dream changes completely.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's the thing, is that if we wake up from this dream that we're in now, will the world disappear? No. Our perspective of the world will be completely different.
Okay.
So that's why, like I said, your question about if I'm no longer here, there's still a universe there, implied in your question is that there's a me here to begin with, an independent me. If that's the assumption, then there must be an independent world. So, must be. So the question, you can't answer it. You can't answer someone's question like that because they're inbuilt in the question is an invalid assumption. See what I mean?
Yeah.
It would be like... maybe it'll come later.
Because you're not saying mass disappears. It's the perception of mass.
Right. I mean, even if we reduce everything to atoms and subatomic particles and quarks, aren't atoms and subatomic particles and quarks concepts? Aren't they?
Yeah.
So you know, we can go down, 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 and there's no bottom. But again, the big problem here is that we come into this investigation assuming that there's a me here investigating what's out there. That's the problem. That's why generally we start by investigating ourselves. And if we come to realise there's no independent me, then implicitly we'll realise there's no independent world. And this is where the whole process starts to go wrong, as we're going to see, is with me. You had a question?
Why is it so wrong to be independent from the universe?
That's coming. That's coming. Okay. That's coming. That's very, very soon. Very soon. In about probably 10 minutes, I'll answer that question. So let's have a look now, maybe a bit more than 10, depends how much I have to say, but it's definitely going to be answered. Let's now have a look at these two things based on this understanding now, and see if we can understand these in a slightly deeper way. So things exist depending on causes and conditions. So this is supposed to be a timeline, this is supposed to be a seed, and this is a plant. So we say that the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. The underlying cause is the seed. The conditions are the soil, sunlight, water, and so forth. And we believe that things exist independently, independent of our conception. So the question here is, when does, in this timeline, when does the seed stop existing and the plant start existing? When does the seed turn into a plant in this timeline? At what point does that happen? When does the seed become the plant?
It stops having the shape of the seed.
Tell me. This one? This one?
We know the last one for sure, right?
So this is the seed. This is a seed.
Yeah, and then there's no longer a seed on the next one. I'm saying for the sake of the
so if it's sort of like a squiggly thing, that's a plant?
Yeah. Maybe the seed's not there anymore.
Okay. So when we look at this, it sort of then dawns on us that there's no fixed point. The point at which, as you're trying to answer, in fact, it becomes obvious. The point at which the seed becomes a plant is exactly the point at which this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant. That's when the seed becomes the plant. We determine that. So for some of us, it could be here, some of us here, some of us here. But that's not what we're intuitively believing. We're believing is an independent seed, independent plant, independent of our conception, which means it should be obvious and fixed at the point at which the seed becomes the plant. Also, here's a question. The seed becomes the plant, but does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? Yes or no? So again, the question is, does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? There's only two answers, yes or no. Which one is it?
No.
No? So the seed is existing at the same time as the plant, that means. Impossible. If something is in a cause and effect relationship, the cause cannot exist at the time of the result. Otherwise, it's not in a cause and effect relationship by definition. So the answer cannot be no. The cause cannot exist at the same time as a result. Impossible. But then if we say yes, So we said, yes, the seed goes out of existence before the plant comes into existence. So the seed has ceased to exist. Where does the plant come from? Where is it coming from? The seed's already stopped. So not possible. So not possible. Neither of them are possible. We never think about this though, do we? And that is a logical absurdity of believing in independent existence. If you believe in independent existence, it's actually logically absurd for a seed to become a plant. It just can't happen. Because it can't exist at the same time, and if it stops to exist before, then there's no plant. And in fact, Nagarjuna, great Indian master, the founder of the Middle Way philosophical system in the 2nd century, wrote a classic text called The Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, where he has 27 chapters of these sorts of arguments, saying, you believe in independent existence? What about the seed and the plant? What about fire and fuel? What about agent and action? And he gives all of these examples like this to show you how our belief in independent existence is actually logically absurd. It just can't work. And so that's one example. Another thing here. We say that the result exists depending on the cause. But this view is also saying the cause exists depending on the result. Why? Why does the cause depend on the result? How can you call something a seed if you don't have the idea that it can potentially produce something? The idea of seed, the concept of seed, implies a potential to produce a plant. Whether or not it does is irrelevant. So to call something a seed or a cause implies concept of plant or result. Therefore, you can only have a cause, concept of cause, if you have the concept of result, even though it's not come into existence yet. So cause exists depending on result because of this. Sure. There's a flow, yes.
And that is independent.
Actually, that's a good point. You know, we talk about, again, we have to draw lines to make sense. So we draw lines and say that's seed, that's plant. But actually, if you step back a little bit and your vision was very accurate, you would just see a flow, a flux of stuff, no? But we need to break it up into these logical units. The problem is that we then make that more solid and we believe that they're there from their own side. That's the problem.
If you don't label it, things happening, that flow, if
it's
you
happening.
Don't label,
yeah.
It does exist independent of us.
No. That's coming. Parts. Let's have a look at parts now. This pen depends on parts. Normally we say the pen, there's a pen there, yeah? That's a pen. This is a pen. Where is the pen? Show me where the pen is. Is that a pen? No, is it a pen? That's the question. Is that a pen?
Not a full pen.
No, it's not a pen. Yes? Is that a pen? The spring thing. No, well, let's take this first. This tube. Is that a pen?
No.
This spring, this thing here, is that a pen?
No.
Is just the plastic tube. The ink inside, is that a pen?
No,
I'm asking the questions. Is this ball on the end a pen? Is the metal tip a pen? Where's the pen? And then people go, oh, yeah. The pen's the collection of all that stuff. No? Okay. There's a pen. There's a collection of it. That's a pen? No? Why not? That's a collection of the bits.
In a certain way.
Ah, certain way. Okay, you tell me when the pen comes into existence. All right? So there's no pen yet? Okay, look closely. You have to tell me exactly when the pen comes into existence, okay? If I can do this correct. Tell me. Don't miss it. No, not yet. Not yet. Not yet. Almost. Ah, so yet? Not yet? Not yet? No. Tell me. Oh! So when did the pen come into existence? It came into existence when this configuration of data closely enough resembled your concept of pen. Your concepts generally have two features, appearance and functionality. So when this had a close enough appearance and appeared to have the functionality of your idea of pen, then the pen comes into existence. So we determine when the pen comes into existence. If this was a pen from its own side, independent of our conception, that would mean a caveman who walked into this room would go, oh, there's the pen I was missing, and start writing a letter. Or a dog would come in and go, oh, there's that pen, I've got to write a dog letter. But what's a caveman going to see? Maybe they'll see some sort of weapon to stab some animals. A dog maybe sees a chewing stick. So is this a pen, a weapon, or a chewing stick? Depends on us. Yeah? Again, the pen, the whole, depends on its parts. Obvious. But also this view is saying the part depends on the whole. You can only call something a part if you have the idea of whole. Something can only be a part of a pen if you have the idea of pen. So part depends on whole as well.
Did you say whole or idea of whole?
No, just whole. Part depends on whole. Here's a little indication if we're getting this idea. Whether we're really starting to understand emptiness. Normally we say this is a pen. Or simply, the pen is the collection of the parts. That's what we normally accept. But this view is saying the pen exists depending on the collection of the parts. So the first statement is the pen is the collection of the parts. The second statement is saying the pen exists depending on the collection of the parts. If we can appreciate those two things are not saying the same thing, we're beginning to understand something about emptiness. So the pen is the collection of the parts, is normally what we think. This view is saying the pen exists depending on the collection of the parts. If we can appreciate those two statements are not saying the same thing, we're beginning to understand something about emptiness. So again, when we look out on the world, to make sense of the world, we draw lines and give names. No problem there. In fact, we have to do that. If we don't do that, we could simply not function. No problem with drawing lines, giving names. The problem comes is that we don't realize we're doing that. The problem comes is because we believe that the world is already divided up into separate bits and things. So our line drawing becomes what's called a hard boundary. The world appears to us as if full of boundaries, full of separate discrete things, existing of course completely independent of our conception. And then the question here was, well, what's the problem with that? Why is that a problem? Why is it a problem to walk in the door and think there's already a cup here? What's the big deal? Why is that a problem? We looked at that yesterday, except my examples disappeared, the little nice flowers here, but we'll use the cup. If we really believe that this world is already divided up, so when we walk in the door there's already a cup here, then remember every time we experience things we either have a pleasant, unpleasant or neutral feeling. And so let's say we walk in and we see this cup, believing that it's already there, existing independent of us. and we happen to have a pleasant feeling, then of course we'll go on to believe, because that's existing independent of my conception, that there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant feeling. So we're going to see this as inherently attractive. Then of course I'm getting a pleasant feeling that appears to have a positive, a good quality that is causing my pleasant feeling. I like pleasant feelings, that seems to be the cause of them. I want that cup, attachment. Or alternatively, if we have an unpleasant feeling, the opposite, aversion. That's the problem with seeing the world as separate from us. Particularly when it comes to people, that attachment and aversion, particularly aversion, can turn into hostility, anger, hatred, and wars come from that. That's the problem. That's the problem. So if we happen to have a pleasant feeling and we see this inherently attractive, we're saying that the beauty is there. But don't we say in our English language, beauty is in the eye of the beholder? Don't we say that? I've heard that somewhere. That's completely in line with the Buddhist view. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And even though intellectually we may understand that and appreciate that, is that how we behave? Is that how we behave? Do we behave as if beauty is in the eye of the beholder? If we did, we would never crave anything. We would never have attachment to anything. We would simply enjoy things. In fact, we enjoy things much more than we do now. But experientially, we believe the beauty is in the person, the new car, the food, the money, all of these things. We believe it's there. That's why we're craving it. So what we need to do is to turn beauty in the eye of the beholder from intellectual understanding into experience. And we can do that by realizing dependent arising. By realizing emptiness, we will directly realize beauty in the eye of the beholder. Does that mean things stop becoming beautiful? No. In fact, it means we will enjoy the beauty much more than we do now. Because when we have a craving and attachment for pleasant things, that agitates the mind, it interferes with our enjoyment. We know, for example, if we have strong craving for chocolate cake, you know, then we get a piece of chocolate cake, how often do we just eat it so fast that we don't really enjoy it, and maybe sometimes we eat too much and we get sick. And of course, if we go to the store to get our favourite bit of chocolate cake and the person in front of us gets the last piece, we tend to get a little bit upset. This is all from wrong view. If we didn't have this wrong view, then if we had the chocolate cake, we would eat it, we wouldn't eat too much, we'd enjoy it, we'd have a much better experience. Much better experience. We'd enjoy things much, much more than we do now. Because often the complaint people say is that if I realise this, you know, everything will become bland and boring. In fact, things are bland and boring now because of our ignorance. Because we're grasping, we always want something bigger and bigger and better and better and better. So things which are actually attractive, we get bored with. If we let go of this ignorance, and this is a little bit in my experience in retreat a little bit, things become more and more beautiful, more and more beautiful. Like, you know, even this self-grasping, if it becomes a little bit weak through doing some retreat, you know, like I've done a couple of long retreats, and usually I go where there's somewhere where they provide meals because I don't like to cook, and generally they, you know, repetitious, every week the same thing. So if you're there for months eating the same things every week, we tend to get sick of it, no? But my experience was that every week food got tastier, got better, because the grasping was, I mean, I didn't realise emptiness or anything, but at least from retreat, the grasping got a little bit minimised. So actually the food got better, I was actually appreciating the scenery around me, little things were like amazing, beautiful, I mean, it's really like that, really. So that's what we got to look forward to. Okay. Right. Next point. So far we've been talking about looking out on the world, and you know, we're drawing these lines, giving names. You have to do that. But again, the problem is we don't realise we're doing that. We don't realise we're dividing up the world. It seems like it's already divided up. So our lines turn into these hard boundaries. We're seeing the world as made up of many separate things, lots of boundaries everywhere. But of course, in most of our experiences, the very first line we draw in our experience is we draw a line around here, about around this part of the experience, and then give the label me or experiencer. Because in single experience, there's two aspects. There's the experiencer and the experienced. So again, we have to do this. In fact, I think a newborn baby can't even do that. A newborn baby can't even distinguish itself from the world. It has to learn that. So it's something we have to learn. In fact, this line drawing we're doing, we're continually improving our line drawing as we go. Particularly when we see something we've never seen before, we sort of scratch our heads and we don't know how to draw the line or how to make meaning. We have to learn that. So from when we're a baby till when we die, we're continually improving our line drawing ability. So again, we have to draw the line and give the name me. Otherwise, we couldn't distinguish the experiencer from the experienced.
Like, if it was the baby trying to identify something moving, like the mother moving across the field, there's a group of energy or whatever that moves across.
Yeah, but what I understand is for some months even, the baby can't distinguish anything itself from other things. That's my understanding anyway.
Just that it wasn't a baby. It was isn't there a group of atoms at least moving across that we're drawing a group line around?
Yeah, but how many things are there?
But there's a lot of things moving across there.
Right, there's a lot of things everywhere.
But
so
it's a group.
Correct. Okay. And?
That group exists.
Sure. Just like a cup exists. This view is not saying nothing exists. We're asking how do things exist? How does the mother exist? How does the cup exist? Yes, there's a cup. How does it exist? That's the question. Yeah. So we have to be careful about that. And that's going to come up in the next part of the text. Is that often when we do this investigation, we end up thinking, oh, nothing really exists. But that's coming. It's coming. So, yes, so again, in our experiences, we draw a line around here, label me, world, me, you, whatever. Experiencer, experience, subject, object, whatever labels we apply. So again, we have to do this to make meaning, to make sense. But again, the problem is that we don't realise we're doing this line drawing, and so we contract around the me part of the experience. We split ourselves off from the experience and believe that there's an independent me here already. This is called self-grasping. Is grasping onto the belief that the me part, the experiencer part of the experience, is existing independently of the experienced. That's self-grasping. Completely illogical. To highlight that, here's a question for you. Is this big? Is that big?
Depends on what you're comparing.
Okay. Is that big compared to that? So big only exists relative to small. You can't have big on its own, yeah? Likewise, up only exists depending on down, in, out, and so forth. Likewise, me only exists depending on not me, or you, the world, however you want to label the not me. You can only have me relative to what's not me. For example, me, from this perspective, is here. From your perspective, it's there. Yeah? So me is depending on you or the world. But that's not how we see ourselves. We see ourselves as existing independent. There's an independent me here and an independent world there. That self-grasping, that belief in an independent me, is exactly the same as saying this is big. I mean, just make no sense at all. But that's how we're behaving, which means we are splitting ourselves off from the world, because you can only have experiencer if there's experienced. You can only have subject if there's object. But we see ourselves as independent, so we are splitting ourselves off from the world, which means we're completely out of sync with reality. We are fighting against reality. And no wonder then we struggle, we suffer, and we have problems. Of course we do. We're fighting against reality. And often we're struggling heavily against reality, because very often in our experiences we have strong self-grasping. Very often in many of our experiences we have always the perspective of me going there, me doing that, me saying this, me, 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 me. So we're always in our, many, very often in our, all of our activities have a strong sense of a me doing something. So the focus is on me. This is self-grasping. The more we have that focus, the more we struggle, the more we have problems, we suffer. But sometimes in our activities, that self-grasping is not so strong. And that often occurs because we're more focused on the activity. Particularly if we have good concentration and we're focusing on the activity rather than the me doing the activity. And we have this experience quite often. For example, if we're absorbed in a good book, absorbed in a movie, absorbed in fixing a problem at work. In those occasions, we are focusing much more on the activity rather than the me doing the activity. And we know from our own experience, in those situations, things seem to flow very nicely. Time seems to go quickly. Doesn't seem to be any great dramas. Things seem to go a lot better. Why? Because we're not struggling against reality so much. There's still self-grasping there a little bit, but a lot less than if it's me, me, me doing this me, me, me. This is very much amplified in people who have developed a high level of concentration in their activities. For example, professional musicians, professional sports people have spent thousands of hours training in their activity. And they've developed a high level of focus. And so when they engage in their activity, they often talk about being in the zone, in the flow state, where they're completely immersed in the activity. The self-grasping is very, very much reduced. And often they report on that occasion that, well, there was just the music playing. There was just the activity. There was no real sense of me. And also at those times, these people report peak performance, optimum performance. Why? Because we're not getting in the way. We're not grasping on the me and struggling against reality. We're much more in sync with reality. That's why it's peak performance. But of course, that is not getting rid of self-grasping. That is only reducing it a lot through the power of concentration. Here, we're talking about eliminating self-grasping altogether so that we can be at peak performance 24/7, we can be completely in sync with reality 24/7. Life will flow much, much better and we'll overcome all of our sufferings. So if we can realize this emptiness, if we can realize there's no independent me, no independent world, we can realize there's not one single boundary in the entire universe. Certainly there's no boundary between here and everywhere else. And so if we can realize that, we'll be able to realize boundless love and compassion for everyone. Because as long as we believe there's a me here and a them there, as long as we believe there's a boundary here, there's some like distance or gap between us and others, it becomes very difficult to fully develop love and compassion. But as soon as we realize there's no boundary between us and anyone else, we're all interdependent. When we really directly realize that, it's said that our love and compassion for others will literally explode to a level we never thought possible. Because we've directly realized there's no distance between us and anyone else. How do we do that? How do we come to realise that? Again, generally it's recommended when we do this investigation of the nature of reality, we begin with ourself as a person. For a couple of reasons. One is that me, the person, is something very familiar to us, something familiar to investigate. And secondly, this self-grasping is where the whole process starts to go wrong. It's belief in independent me leads to all of our problems. So we have to look here to see how do I exist as a person. Now, generally, again, we have this self-grasping. We have a strong sense of me. Particularly when we're in a situation that evokes an emotional response. We have a strong sense of me. How does that me appear to us? That me that we're identifying with appears very solid and self-existent. It appears to not depend on anything else for its existence. I think that's how it appears to us. And it appears to be somewhere here. But where is this me that is the centre of the universe? So in the reflection, in the meditation, a bit hot, a bit of air con, what we do is we look for this me. Where is this me here? And so we can search for the me. And we can do this search in a number of ways, but a very simple way is we search the body. Can the me be found anywhere in the body? Can you find the me here anywhere? And wherever we look, we just find parts of the body. But then we might say, well, the body as a whole is the me. We have to think about that. Is the body me, or is the body something which I possess, something which I have? Do I have a body? If I have a body, I can't be the body. You can't be something and have it at the same time. So either we are the body or we have a body. Which is it? I think we can appreciate that I have a body. What about the mind? Again, we search the mind everywhere. You know, where is the me? Where is the me? Is anything in the mind the me? We look.
The mind be the me.
So then we can say, is the mind itself the me? So again, we can ask the same question. Either the mind is me or I have a mind. Do I have a mind or I am the mind? Which is it? I think we have a mind, no? We can't have something and be it at the same time. So the mind cannot be me because I have a mind. But then people often say, well, that's obvious that I'm not the mind and body because I'm the collection of the two. Yeah? But here again, we use the same logic, investigation. The body is not me, right? I have a body. The mind is not me. I have a mind. If we put the body and the mind together, what do we get? We get a collection of two things which I have. I have a body and a mind. So same logic again. The body and the mind together cannot be me because they're two things which I have. So then, where is the me? So we should be able to take away everything that's not me and be left with the me. So the body's not me, so we can get rid of that. The mind is not me, I can get rid of that. So if we get rid of the body and the mind, what's left here? Nothing. Is there? Nothing. And so usually what happens here is that people do this search, and if they do the search in a good way, often people have a lot of fear coming up. If you're doing the search and you have a lot of fear coming up, very good sign. It means that you're doing the investigation very clearly and correctly. The only problem is you're coming to a wrong conclusion of the search. Because now, for us, there's two possibilities. either there is this solid independent me or there's no me. Because the only me that we've identified with in our entire life is this independent me. That's the only one we've ever identified with. So if that doesn't exist, then there's no me. Question. No, not in this context. Here, this investigation is we're looking at how do I exist? Yeah? And we believe that there is an independent me here. So if there's really an independent me here, we should be able to search and find it. We should be able to point to it and say, there's the me. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for the independent me that we believe in. And then we search. We don't seem to be able to find it. And again, generally, often what happens is people who start to do this search sometimes develop a lot of fear because they feel like they're going out of existence because they can't find the me. But again, it means you're doing well on the search. It just means you're coming to the wrong conclusion. Because so far, for us, again, there's only two possibilities. Either there is this independent me or there's no me. Because the only me we've identified with our entire life is this independent me. And if we can't find it, that's more or less saying to us there's no me at all. Because we don't see any other possibility. But if we're having that fear experience, one way of overcoming it is you can ask yourself, if you're fearing going out of existence, you can ask yourself, who's having the fear? If there's no me, there can't be a fear. So you're not going out of existence. Yeah? You're not going out of existence. What's going out of existence is a false sense of me. A me that you've believed in your entire life that has been the root cause of all your problems and sufferings. That belief in a me is going out the window. So if you do the search and you don't find the me, you hold that experience of not finding. That experience of not finding is an experience of emptiness. Remember, emptiness means not independently existent. So we've searched for the independent me, we didn't find it, we've conclusively established there's no independent me. So that not finding is an experience of emptiness, so we hold that experience as long as we can in meditation and allow it to sink in more and more and more in our mind.
So there's no me?
No, there's no independent me. Right? I'm coming to this now. So we hold that as long as we can and allow it to sink in more and more. If we do this meditation well, with good concentration, that impact of that experience will have an effect on our mind that will continue to affect our mind after the meditation. Maybe for some minutes, hours, days, or even weeks, if it's a very strong experience. During that time, the self-grasping will be very much reduced because of this experience. What you will notice is that during that time, you'll feel much closer to people than you normally do. You'll find that particularly small negative states of mind, like irritations and stuff, won't come up as they normally do. Things won't really bother you as much as they did. It'll be harder for you to get angry at people. It'll be harder for you to get craving for things. You'll have these experiences, but of course they'll slowly wear off as the self-grasping gets stronger and stronger. So the idea being, of course, we need to continue to do this reflection, particularly developing a very strong, focused mind, which is, of course, what we're going to be looking at. The 3-day retreat's all about doing that, how to do that. And then that experience can really deepen and affect our life more and more and more and longer and longer and longer, until we have a direct experience of it. But here, what I was just saying, if we look now at the next verse on page 144, the second verse, it says the definition of not having completed the analysis of the right view. It says, if the appearances of dependent relation, which is unbetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, then one has still not realized the Buddha's intent. Which means that Now, as I said, when we do this investigation on emptiness, when we investigate emptiness, then we don't find this me, this solid me. It seems like there's no me at all. And so we sort of fall to the extreme of nihilism. Therefore, emptiness seems to be opposite to things existing and functioning. And things existing and functioning are these, you know, things are dependent arisings, yeah? So the fact that things exist and function and are dependent arising seems to be opposite to emptiness. Because when we've investigated emptiness, things seem to disappear. There seems to be no me. So it seems like either there is a me that functions or there's emptiness. That's what's said here. So if we have that understanding, we haven't really understand emptiness fully yet. So we need to keep working on that. So how does the me exist then if there's no independent me? Is again, the me is something merely labelled depending on the body and the mind. That's the me that exists. The merely labelled me. Just like we draw a line around a collection of data here and then we give it the name cup. So cup exists depending on these collection of parts here. Likewise, the me exists depending on the collection of the body and the mind. So me is something merely labelled on that basis. None of that basis is the me. But on the basis of me, on the basis of the body and the mind, we label me. Lost you? Huh? We are.
If we're doing that type of meditation, is there a possibility of that logic interfering with the actual experience that we're trying to find? And we just, through desperation, we suddenly say, oh yes, you know, I'm merely labelled.
Right. So, yeah, that's a good point. And this is where people sort of get confused in the meditation. They start to do the meditation looking for the me, and they don't find it somewhere here, and they go, oh yeah, yeah, but the me is something merely labelled. But that's not what we're looking for. Because remember, we don't believe in the merely labelled me, do we? Intuitively. Intellectually, you may think, yeah, that sounds reasonable, but how do we behave? We behave as if there's an independent me here. We have self-grasping there in our behaviour all the time. That's the me that we instinctively believe in. That's the me that we got to look for, because that's the one we believe in. So we need to leave out this in our search, otherwise there's confusion. Because the me that we're instinctively believing in is this independent me. That's what we're looking for. See if that, if the me exists like that. And if we don't find that independent me, then we hold that experience of not finding as long as we can. Yeah? So again, the me that does exist, now we see either there is an independent me or there's no me. We don't see a third possibility because we've only experienced the independent me our entire life. We've never experienced me in any other way. The third possibility between independent me and no me, which are the two extremes that we need to avoid, which is coming up shortly, is the dependent me. The me that exists depending on the body and the mind. Example. Let's say you've hurt your ankle. So the ankle is hurt. On the basis that the ankle is hurt, we correctly say, I am hurt. No? So we're labelling me on the basis of the ankle there. Or if we have some thought in the mind, we can label me on the basis of something in the mind. We can label me on any part of the body and the mind depending on the situation and the context. Yeah? So the me is just a label applied to some part of the basis. But of course, we don't realise that. We think there's an independent me here. And that is another example of our old friend cognitive fusion. Because we've got, let's keep it simple, let's use the cup as example here. So we've got the basis here, we've got collection of parts, bits. That's the basis. On that basis, we are applying a label. But there's two things. There's the basis and the label. So correctly, we should say, this is something I'm calling a cup. But what do we say? This is a cup. So we are fusing the basis and the label. Just like the cognitive fusion yesterday, we fused the person and behaviour. That's one example of fusion. Here, the example of cognitive fusion is we're fusing the basis and the label. And we say, this is a cup. Which means, though, if we fuse the label and the basis, it means everyone who walks in the door here must see cup. Does a caveman see cup? Does a dog see cup? No. So again, this is what we do. So that's, we're fusing the label with the basis.
Isn't that a valid basis?
Right, but it's only a valid basis. It's not the imputed object. It's the basis. So you have the basis and the label. They're two things, distinct things. You're applying the label to the basis. The label is not the basis, is it? You're applying it to the basis.
I used to think, as quite a young person, that what if no one actually saw the cup the way I did, that it existed independent of, I was the only one in this whole room that saw the cup like that.
In fact, we're all experiencing slightly different, aren't we? Particularly me and you. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of things you're not seeing. Yeah, I mean, you're all seeing something. You're all having a different experience, aren't you? No, not identical. No. I mean, if there is a cup there, then the qualities must be there, which means that if you experience it as beautiful, then everyone must experience it as beautiful because it's there. It's not, is it? Beauty is here. Cup is here. No.
Are you implying that, or can it, am I going along the right path if I think that we could be the observer depending on our body and mind?
The me exists depending on the body and the mind, yes.
Is it?
But generally the observer, depending on what we're observing, if we're observing something visual where the observer is labelled depending on the vision. If we're thinking about something, the observer is labelled on the mind. No? Or if we're hearing something, the observer is labelled on the basis of the ear faculty. Yeah? So it depends on what mode of observing, what the me is labelled, on what the basis is. It could be the visual faculty, the hearing faculty, it could be the mental faculty. We're labelling me on that basis and calling that the observer. But observer is just a label applied to that basis.
Is the me dependent only on body and mind, or dependent on everything out there?
Well, again, what we can say is that the me exists depending on not me. You can only talk about me if there's something that's not me, no? In fact, if we look at how we learn and identify objects, it's a little bit like that. Like, for example, a young baby, the mother's trying to teach the young child things. So they've got a pet cat. So there's a cat there, and the mother says to the child, cat, cat, cat. And so the child, in a very rough way, sees something with four things sticking down and goes, four things sticking down is cat. Yeah? That's all she sees. So then she sees, the baby sees a table and goes, cat, 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 because it's four things sticking down. Mother goes, no, 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 table, table. So then the baby distinguishes, oh, cat is something that's four things, but it moves. That doesn't move. So then the pet dog comes in and the baby goes, cat, cat, cat. And the mother goes, no, 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 dog, dog, dog. And so then the baby refines the concept of cat. Oh, it moves, but it's also got this different sort of tail and thing at the end here, and at the other end there's something a bit different and a bit smaller than the other thing that's called a dog. So that's how we learn. We learn from what it's not, you know. So this is the whole process of learning. If we look now at the next verse, it says here, if these two realizations are happening simultaneously without alternation, and from merely seeing dependent relation as completely unbetraying, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys the way all objects are apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. So if we take that verse and the previous verse together, what we can understand in simple language is now when we begin this investigation on emptiness, then, as I said, emptiness and functioning world seem to be contradictory. Either things work and they're real, or they're empty and nothing really exists. Because in our experience looking for the me, we don't find it, so we think, well, there's no me at all. So it seems like emptiness contradicts functioning world, or emptiness contradicts dependent arising. That's what's been said in the previous verse. Then if we continue to reflect on this idea of emptiness, dependent arising, instead of saying, you know, at the beginning we'll say things like, if things are empty, they can't function. If things function, they can't be empty. That's the first step, the wrong understanding, that they're somehow contradictory. Then if we continue to reflect on that and to really begin to improve our understanding of emptiness, dependent arising, we'll start to say things like, okay, despite the fact that things are empty, they do work. And despite the fact that they work, they are empty. So we're sort of compromising a bit. But the real measure, what's being said in the second verse here, is that when we deepen our understanding of emptiness and dependent arising, we'll come to really appreciate, because things are empty of independent existence, they can function. And because things function, they must be empty of independent existence. That's what's being said in this verse here. That by understanding that things are empty of independent existence, we will then really understand that they are a dependent arising. And by merely understanding that things are dependent, we'll understand that will trigger an understanding that things are empty of independent existence. So that's the real measure. And so emptiness and dependent arising are like two sides of one coin. Yeah? And so that's what's being said here. When we realise that, when we really come to understand, because things are empty of independent existence, they can function. And because things function, they must be empty of independent existence. Because if this here was inherently a cup, if it was a cup from its own side, then it couldn't do anything. It couldn't change. It couldn't become anything else. You couldn't create it. You couldn't destroy it. But because it's not a cup from its own side, therefore things change. And depending on how they change, we apply different labels. And then we have no problem. So this is a measure of how well we understand emptiness. And just one more point on that, if we go to the next verse, at the bottom of page 144, it says, furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, then you are not captivated by wrong notions holding extreme views. So what does all that mean? Let's try and make that a little bit more simple, if that's possible. As I already mentioned, there are two extremes we're trying to avoid. Which here is translated, one is his existence, translated in this way, existence and non-existence. By existence here, we mean independent existence. So this is the extreme we're generally stuck in now. We believe in an independent me. That's the extreme of existence. And existence here implies inherent existence or independent existence. So that's the extreme we're generally stuck in now. But then, of course, when we investigate emptiness, where's this independent me, we don't find it. Generally, we flip to the other extreme of non-existence or nihilism, saying, well, nothing exists then. I couldn't find it, it doesn't exist. Because for us, again, at the moment, there's only two possibilities. Either there is independent me and world, or no me and no world. So generally, we flip from that extreme to this one, because we find that there's no independent existence, and we tend to feel, oh, nothing exists then. So these are the two extremes we're trying to avoid. And what's being said in the text here is, how do we overcome this extreme? How do we overcome the extreme of believing in independent existence? How do we do that? We realize there's no independent existence. We realize emptiness. So emptiness, a realization of emptiness, will help us to overcome this extreme. So that's the antidote. When we realize emptiness, we realize there's no independent existence. How do we overcome the extreme of non-existence? Nothing exists. We understand that everything is dependent. Everything is a dependent arising. So dependent arising, the fact that everything is a dependent phenomena, overcomes the extreme that nothing exists. But what this paragraph here is saying is that really the measure of completing our understanding of the right view is that we can use dependent arising also to overcome the extreme of existence. Because if things are dependently existent, they can't be independently existent. So this dependent arising can also be the antidote. I mean, this is by really appreciating they're two sides of one coin, we can flip them. And so we can understand that dependent arising is also, by understanding dependent arising, that things are dependent, overcomes the fact that they're independent. And also, by realizing emptiness, that things are empty of inherent existence, overcomes the fact that they're not non-existent, because we're only understanding that they're empty of inherent existence, and that doesn't mean empty of existence in general. So emptiness here can also, if we really have a full understanding of the view, this can overcome this extreme as well. That's what's being said in this. So that's a sign that we've really now fully understood empty's dependent arising. Now, to help also understand emptiness, because emptiness is a very profound topic. So very often in the texts, when a difficult topic is presented, they usually use some sort of simple analogy to try and understand what we're talking about. In emptiness presentations, many analogies used. One of the most common and one of my favourite analogies to understand what emptiness and dependent arising really means is the analogy of a dream. Now, when we're dreaming, in a normal dream, in that dream, there really does appear to be a dream me and an independent dream world in the dream. Yeah? So there really does appear to be a dream me, independent dream world. So in that dream world, in our dream, if we see like a monster in the dream, we have a lot of fear and try and run away. If we see a nasty person in the dream, we may get angry at them and abuse them. So we react to the dream landscape believing that it's independent of us, and we react with a lot of disturbing emotions because of that fact. But if suddenly in the dream we suddenly realize, hang on, this is a dream, so we develop what's called lucid dreaming, which is not so difficult. If suddenly in the middle of the dream we realize this is a dream, then of course the dream doesn't disappear, the dream still, there still appears to be a me here and a dream world there, so it still appears to be an independent dream world, but now we will realize that this whole dream landscape is a product of our mind, which means that our perspective of the dream will be completely different, which means that actually if a monster appeared in a dream, it would actually become very difficult to develop fear, because we would know we're creating the monster. So we may see the monster in the dream, and then if we're lucid, we go, oh, hi, Mr. Monster, you seem a little bit upset. What's the problem? Or, you know, if an angry person comes in the dream, it would be hard to get angry at them because, you know, we're creating the nasty person. So it means that our perspective of the dream will be radically different. It means that actually we would enjoy our dream a lot more, and it means that the disturbing emotions in the dream would be very hard to arise. So likewise, what this view here is saying is that our waking life is like a dream. Meaning that like a dream, here also in our waking life, there appears to be a me here and an objective world out there, just like a dream. And as a result, we react to situations with a lot of disturbing emotions like anger and fear and so forth, just as we do in a dream. But what this view is saying is that if we wake up from our sleep of ignorance, if we become lucid in our waking state, if we come to realize that this world is also a product of our mind, then the world's not going to disappear like in a lucid dream, but our perspective of the waking world will become completely different. Which means, just like a lucid dream, it would be hard to develop any disturbing emotions in our waking life, and we'd enjoy life a hell of a lot more. So that's one analogy to help us understand what really emptiness and dependent arising mean. I find it a very helpful one. And in particular, to be able to develop lucid dreaming can be useful in this nature of reality investigation. Because one of the things that people often report who've developed lucid dreaming, one of the most common comments is that they're completely amazed at how vivid and real the dream world looks. That it's just a product of the mind, but how vivid and real it looks. So maybe it's the same with the waking world. Maybe also it's looking vivid and real, but it's really a product of the mind. So that can help us to maybe appreciate that that could be the case. Okay. The last two lines of that verse we looked at the top of page 145, it says, if you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect. So cause and effect here, of course, is dependent arising. So sometimes a little bit poetically, they say that things are arising out of emptiness. Things are manifesting out of emptiness. So this is what's being said here, really. It says, then you are not captivated by wrong notions holding extreme views. Here, extreme views are these two views, that either things exist independently or there's nihilism. So they're the two extreme views that we can avoid. So if we understand this, we can avoid these two extreme views. We can sort of go in between, understanding that things are dependently existent. Then if we go to the very last verse, it says, in this way you realize exactly the vital points of the three principal aspects of the path. Resort to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child. So what it's saying here is that it's all well and good having some intellectual understanding of these principal aspects, but we need to put them into practice, we need to internalize them, we need to come to really realize renunciation, bodhicitta, and directly realize the wisdom of emptiness. And if we do that by putting a lot of joyous effort into our practice, we can quickly accomplish our goal, the goal of enlightenment. What I would like to do now would be to talk a little bit about how we progress along the various stages to enlightenment, but we're running a bit short on time, so maybe we do some questions, and if we still have time, I can mention something. I want to give you opportunity to ask some questions.
Yeah, I'm having thoughts about what you talked about yesterday, which is the difference between the nirvana, body, suffering,
sure,
enlightenment. And I know this is wrong view, but it appears to me that the bodhisattva path is, it's appearing as a more as a tool for achieving an end, as opposed to because if everything is in a sense labeling and dependent on its parts and causes and conditions, then surely there is no world that needs to be saved. There's separate the bodhisattva.
Separate, no. But
that if a bodhisattva, or if an arhat achieves a state of realizing, you know, the true nature of reality, then there is no world to be saved. Well, there is no.
There's no exactly. But there is a world. There's a dependent world to be saved.
But that's an illusion, isn't it?
No. We have to be very careful here. So remember, I just said here that things are like a dream. They're like an illusion. We have to be very careful here and say like. If we say everything's an illusion, illusions don't really exist.
But
there is a cup. I mean, you know, there is a cup here.
No,
there's a person here. There's people suffering.
People suffering, isn't that...
And they're suffering...
Isn't that, in a sense, an idea in itself, a label?
Yeah, but that's existence.
That's what I mean. That's just existence. That's just the way things are.
Correct.
As opposed to, it needs to change.
Everything's changing anyway, all the time, isn't it? I mean, nothing stays the same one moment to the next. So here the trick is that this... See, this is the sort of we're flipping from one extreme to the other. You know, oh, there's no independent world to be saved. Oh, there's no nothing to do. That's nihilism.
No, but in terms of what we call relative truth, of course,
yeah,
there is a path and there is a a journey to be taken. Place is reached, which is I'm just comparing the arhat,
right,
and bodhisattva,
right,
right. Once that place is reached, then the idea of there needing to be reincarnation and coming back in order to benefit sentient beings seems like that in itself is part of,
yes, that's right,
the illusion of
the illusion.
You're
saying as if it's not really real or functioning.
No, that it's a play, and that the idea...
Of course it's a play, but the problem is we don't realise it's a play, and that's why we suffer.
But when you realise it's a play, then there is suffering, and your part, whether you choose
then you
to play your part...
That's right. If you realise it's a play, you can play your part and enjoy it. If you don't realise it's a play, you suffer.
Well, maybe you have to play your part.
So that's the thing. That's the Bodhisattva's goal, is to show to everyone how it's this sort of play, which doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It means that we just have to understand how these things exist and then thereby overcome suffering. So we're not trying to, again, we have to be very careful that by showing this, we're not somehow saying, well, it doesn't really matter because nothing really exists. We're flipping to the other extreme of nihilism.
Well, I'm not exactly saying that, but I'm just saying that when you wake up from your dream, of course the dream is still there.
Correct.
But
correct. And you know it's a dream, and
you don't get
suffer.
Caught up in the drama.
Huh?
You don't get caught up in the
correct.
Drama.
But everyone else that you see in the dream, you know that they're getting caught up in the drama, and therefore it burns you. You really want to help them to also see that it's like a dream, because you know that they're suffering immensely because they don't realize that. That's why you're going to go to enlightenment.
Although the me in them that is suffering immensely is...
The me that's suffering... Hang on.
Not real.
No. Who's the me now that's suffering?
Well, it's a made up...
No, the me that's suffering is the me that exists, the dependent me. The one we believe in, the independent me, here's the crux. The independent me, the one we believe in, never has existed, can't exist, never will exist. No?
Yeah.
But because we believe in it, we suffer. The we that believes in that is the me that does exist, the dependent me. That's the me that exists. So it's the dependent me that's suffering.
Yeah.
Because the independent me does not exist. But we believe in that. That's why we suffer. No? So when you wake up in the dream, you look at all the other people, they're all suffering because those people you see are dependent people, correct? They're all dependent people you're seeing, but they don't realize that. They think they're independent. That's why they're suffering. That's why you need to help them.
Yeah. I suppose I'm just wondering whether there is a level where you get to where the suffering is...
Suffering only comes from a belief in that independent me.
If everything is interdependent,
right,
then...
there's a question over here. Yeah. Like an illusion.
How do they see suffering?
They
do they see suffering as suffering, or do they see it as someone else? Where do they get a motivation from?
Oh, because they've had a lot of suffering in the past, so they know what it means to suffer, and they know then how everyone else is experiencing it. Because they have had that experience themselves, and now they've seen the truth, and they know directly that it's possible to overcome this suffering, and they know that everyone else is suffering because they haven't seen the truth. So they're desperate to help them. Desperate.
So do they see sentient beings?
Sure. They see sentient beings as a dependent thing, you know. See them correctly. Now when we look at other people, we think that other people exist independently. Of course, the Bodhisattva sees sentient beings. I mean, we all see sentient beings. That's not the question. I mean, everyone sees sentient beings. The question is, how do we believe these sentient beings exist? We believe everyone else is independent of us. Bodhisattva, Arya Bodhisattva, knows, realizes these sentient beings are not independent of them. But they're still sentient beings. There was a question.
They see sentient beings as not independent of them.
Yeah. They know that they're a dependent phenomena. People. Everything is dependent.
You realise it's really difficult,
don't you? Oh, yeah. Sure. This is a big topic, you know. I'm trying to throw it out there in like 2 hours. I mean. Yeah.
We are dependent on each other. Sentient beings, you were saying. So there's no sort of oneness.
Ah, yes. This is a good question. A lot of New Agey things say everyone's one. This is still dualistic. Because now this idea of independent me, independent you is another word for it is duality.
Yeah.
You know, there's a subject-object duality. Yeah. But to say everything's one is still dualistic. Because to have one means two. So, correctly, and this is sometimes a mistranslation in the Tibetan texts, when they talk about non-duality, in the text it literally says not two. And a lot of people translate that as one, which is actually still dualistic. So we're not all one. What we can say is we're all one nature, all one nature of emptiness, but we're not one. One is dualistic. So we have to be a bit careful with how we use the word. What we can say is, technically, we say we're not two, meaning there's not separate, independent me, you. One would mean that I am you. I'm not you. We exist relative, dependent. So to understand that, we say not two, meaning there's not two independent things. So we have to be careful with the word one. I mean, better is to say non-duality or not independent.
It's not quite one.
Not one. No, we're not one. One is dualistic talk. We're one nature. We're not different natures, but we're not one. To have one means you have to have two. Implies two, doesn't it? You have to think about that. It's a bit of a technical point, but I think it's an important point, because otherwise we can sort of get some strange ideas. Because this idea we're all one, it's like we're one big blob, you know, that we're not individuals, that we don't have our own thoughts and so forth. That's completely wrong. Yeah, the same nature. So that's why in Buddhism we can say we're all the same nature in terms of we're all arising out of emptiness. You can say that. That's fine. That's fine. But to say we're all one is technically wrong, and it can be misleading.
Yeah.
Well, to have one, you have to have two. It's dualistic. Anyway, we have to think about that, but it's a little bit of a technicality, but I think it's still important, because otherwise we get all strange ideas. We say we're all one, as if we're, like I said, we're all one big blob or something. I don't know.
So if somebody says that to you, you don't get into a discussion of this, you just agree.
Well, we're all one.
Yes.
Oh, I say we're not different.
Yeah.
We're not independent.
That's a nice one.
Because that's what they mean.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's okay.
We all suffer the same.
Yeah, that's okay. No problem. When I'm talking to people, I don't try not to nitpick too much. But when we're in classes and people are trying to understand a topic, I try to be a little bit precise. Otherwise, we sort of get some strange ideas sometimes. But when I'm talking to people, I just say, oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, you mean we're not independent? Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
About the cup. So, even if the concept of cup doesn't exist on its own side, like when we come in,
the concept of cup or the cup?
Okay, so when
the concept of the cup is not a cup.
So when we come in, there's something there. If we call it a cup or not.
Wait. Who's the we that's coming in the door? See, this is the point.
Yeah, yeah.
Is if you are asking these questions with the assumption that there's a me, independent me, coming in the door, I can't answer your question.
Yeah.
Because I have to say then, of course there's a cup there, because you're assuming that there's a me there, independent, coming in. Then of course there has to be an independent cup by logic, logical conclusion, there must be an independent cup. So it's hard, I can't answer the question,
yeah? I know what you mean, yeah. You really need to
You will, and fortunately, if we work on me and come to see there's no independent me, we will then implicitly realise that the cups are not independent. We don't have to turn our mind to it. It'll just happen. So we don't have to worry about cups so much.
Change
what it's depending on. What do you mean? Well, our body is changing all the time. Like the body we have now, I think according to science or medicine, there's not one atom that's the same as the body from 10 years ago. So the me based on this body is completely 100% different than the me that was labelled on the body 10 years ago.
But we see things that we depend on our body at the moment. I'm depending on my eyes to
like? You mean in terms of parts?
Yeah.
See, these are the three dependencies. Which one do you mean?
Parts.
Well, I think body and mind more or less covers it, generally.
The parts of the body can change depending on the food that we eat.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, my hair, but you cut it off and it's on the table. I mean, it's not really attached to you anymore. We sort of throw it in the bin, don't we? Okay, we've run over time, so again, thank you very much for coming this evening. Before we run off, though, maybe we can spend a short moment just to dedicate any positive merit that we've gathered, positive energy we've gathered over the last three nights, towards the goal of aspiring to have a meaningful life at whatever level we can manage. We can certainly aspire to have an ethical lifestyle. On top of that, if we can, we can aspire to strive to liberate ourselves completely free of suffering. And then on top of that, of course, we can aspire to try to help liberate everyone else from suffering as well. And certainly we can aspire to trying to understand the nature of reality so that we can overcome all of our mental afflictions and ignorance. So let's dedicate then a positive merit towards that worthwhile goal of really making our life most meaningful.